Welcome back. So I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for the Dharma Talk today. I think known to all of you here online and in person, Reverend Linda Jinshi Zwinger. As many of you also know, Linda has been for quite some time now preparing for and stepping into the role of a Zen priest. It's a role that takes extraordinary dedication, and I'm very grateful for that because of the service that it offers all of our Sangha. For several years now, starting off with Linda's Jukai preparation, and in our tradition, it's at least a year-long preparation for someone who is already an experienced practitioner. Culminating with the Jukai ceremony, where Bodhisattva vows are taken, Jukai vows, 16 in the case of our tradition. And Linda, following that, after a period of additional time of practice and study, had indicated her wish to become a priest, to take priest vows. That required a period of postulancy, another couple of years of preparation, which then was followed by an ordination ceremony. Some of you may remember when that occurred. We announced it to the Sangha. And some of you had witnessed that, particularly a small group of people who had already received Jukai within the Sangha. Once the person is ordained as a priest, they become a novice priest, not yet a full priest. And that's done in the tradition to allow additional time. This is really the beginning of a path of very deep commitment. And so Linda began walking that path. At the culmination of that, again, another few years of practice and preparation, some of it quite extensive, we mark that culmination by something called the Denkai ceremony. And that happened just this past Saturday with Linda, with a very, very small group of attendants and witnesses. We did not have our regular open discussion meeting last Saturday. We held it here, rearranged the Zendo in a way to accommodate that ceremony. And in addition to marking the culmination of that novice priesthood, becoming now a full priest, it also gave Linda the authority to transmit herself the precepts in Jukai, and perhaps if she has students of her own who wish to take priest vows eventually, the Bodhisattva vows that are involved in Denkai and in that transmission of the precepts. There will be one more step for Linda, and that will be Dharma transmission, where she is given the authority to teach independently. We're never truly independent, right? Always interconnected, but she's able to take on all of the duties and responsibilities, especially in becoming a teacher and exercising those responsibilities within our Sangha. Now, in monastic practice, it is traditional in Zen for there to be practice periods. They are month-long. In our tradition, Typically, we do three of them each year at Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe. And during one of those practice periods, the person who is at the point where Linda is in her progression in the priest path becomes shuso. Shuso, a Japanese word, simply meaning practice leader for the entirety of that month-long practice period. So traditionally in the monastery, that person takes care basically of everything, all the preparation, the coordination with the meal staff, those residents who are responsible for feeding the monks and the visiting sangha, and also for the structure of the schedule. During that practice period, there is a ceremony called Shuso Hosenshiki. And that is a ceremony in which typically that person gives a talk, and I'll describe that talk very briefly. But during that practice period, that person gives a talk, and then the monks, the visiting sangha, have an opportunity to ask questions, usually in a very formalized ritual sort of way. Well, we're not a monastic practice group. We're a householder or lay practice group. But nonetheless, both Linda and I felt it would be helpful for her to give one of these kinds of talks. I know she's given talks before to the Sangha, as she has been very willing to do. But this is a special kind of talk. We call it a way-seeking talk. And it's a talk in which the person describes their path, particularly how it is that bodhicitta arose for them, that heart for practice, deep, deep heart for practice. And so it's personally biographical. It's meant as a way to more deeply familiarize all of the Sangha with the heart of this person who has been so willing to take on considerable additional responsibility in service of the Sangha. So no more words from me. I'm going to turn it over to Linda asked that she go ahead and unmute herself, and then Mary Ellen, if you would,
once she unmutes,
select speaker.
It's not going to her.
It's going
to
gallery.
Going.
Go back to galleries.
Okay.
That's because
I'm unmuted.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Once you talk, then you are. Okay.
Yeah.
And it'll.
That's. I get my little screen square. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it'll flicker back and forth because of the way this is set up with the room. So, two things are necessary. One is for Linda to talk, and then for all of the rest of us to be very silent, and for us to. Check to make sure that nobody online is unmuted.
I've got them all off.
Great. Linda, please.
Thank you so much, Sensei Al. Thank you all for being here. I see all your lovely faces. Some of them are very tiny because all the TCMC faces are squished into one box. I just wanted to ask first if you can hear me okay. It's working as well. Okay. So without further ado, as Al mentioned, the way-seeking mind talk is a part of our tradition. And you can, if you get interested in that part of our tradition, you can find many examples of really terrific way-seeking mind on the internet.
Oops.
If you were I'm mumbling. All right, let me try again. All right. So this is a way-seeking mind talk. Describing it so beautifully. It's a tradition in our version of Buddhism, and you can find a lot of really good way-seeking mind talk on the internet. You get interested in it. If you do get interested in it and you do find those talks, I hope they will make up to you what's going to happen here. Without further ado. Because I think the only way honestly describe my particular way-seeking mind is it's pretty much constantly stupefied. Seeking, ing, seeking mind. My mind is a gerund. Surprising in an English teacher. I have always had a way-seeking mind in the sense that I have all my life always had the ever-present sense that there's something unseen, unheard, unheard of in the world in which I allegedly live, you guys too, while doing all the things that convince us that we are real, that what we do and where we live in reality is also real. You know, that's pretty much that. And we almost convince ourselves that first there are questions, and then there are answers, and then it's all kind of sorted out and dusted. And yet, people, most people, I think, find themselves yearning for something more. No more answers, maybe. But whatever we've decided about how life works, what the answers to our questions are, nevertheless, I think we go on enacting that yearning in different ways. We look for love. We make families. We find explanations that we can live with, pretty much. We play games, sometimes with deadly earnestness. We break things. We make things. We win, we lose. We give up. We reframe the story. We try again. And always there's something more. Something out there, be something in here. The thing I most remember about both my very early and my current selves, and the two places on the timeline of human life that can harbor simultaneously indelible memories and complete amnesia, is a constant sense lurking that there's always more to it. It being what Douglas Adams dubs in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, life, the universe, and everything. Hilda Radner, the bodhisattva of clear-eyed understanding of how hilarious the human condition really is, in all its tragedies, petty tyrannies, feats of kindness and heroism, and orchestrated horrors, summarized it this way: it's always something. Like, just when you think you have a pretty decent handle on the world, on reality in general, you find out about something you have absolutely no clue about. For me, one moment like this was finding out about glacier mice and tardigrades. Glacier mice are composed of various species of moth. They live in groups on glaciers, obviously. And they move in a non-random herd-like way via rotating, rolling, gliding. They can cover almost an inch a day, thus confounding not only our confident belief that plants are non-ambulatory, but also the settled wisdom embodied in that wisest of sayings, a rolling stone gathers no moth. Come to find out, reality also includes a rolling moss that gathers stones. It also provides ecosystems for other guests, including nematode worms, springtails, and water bears. A nematode worm is a kind of worm found pretty much everywhere. They range in size from 0.1 inch to 26 feet long. It's believed that there may be 1 million species nematode worms. There are a mere 9,000 species of springtails, like nematode worms. There's a lot of them in areas that include soil and related habitats, like moss, for example. It's estimated that you'll find 100,000 individuals in any given square meter. And water bears, third animal guest of our representative glacier mouse, is another name for tardigrade. Tardigrade is an animal with 8 legs extending under its body. And you can't see them unless you have a microscope. The fact that, again with the sound? That's right. Start with water bears?
I was wondering, will you signal me when you want that image to come up?
Yes, could you put it up, please?
Sure.
That'd be great. I didn't know if you got that email. So here's a piece of entertainment for you. This is a tardigrade. Did you see it? Isn't it cute? Hey, thank you, Al. Okay, so this is a tardigrade, and you can't see it unless sharing a picture of it or you have a microscope. And the fact that you can't see it messes with other received bits of wisdom, like you can see animals. It's bacteria and stuff you need a microscope to see, right? The grade's wrong again. And by the way, nematode worms, one of the animals hosted by glacier mice, are known predators of tardigrades. So the nematode worms and the tardigrades, populating any given glacier mouse, have a dog-eat-dog world, just like we do. Tardigrades can live anywhere, including outer space, where they can survive 30 years in a state of cryptobiosis, and most of them can live to tell the tale. That's just crazy. That's why. That's here. And they're here whether you know it or not. What's a way-seeking mind to do with stuff like that? It's actual information, science even, but it doesn't settle anything about life, the universe, and everything. The actual information is, as we say, just a finger pointing at the moon, pointing at our own world, harboring invisible dimensions that are waiting in the wings and probably laughing at us as we keep stockpiling information, never running out of questions, never stopping our yearning for answers. I feel a real affinity with glacier mice in their dogged wanderlust, always on the move, pushing that 0.98 inches a day distance with their 8 little legs, randomly persisting for whatever reason they do that, or for no reason. I remember a Upaya Zen Center weekend workshop I attended quite a while ago. It was in my period of Zen that I assume, or at least I hope, everybody passes through, kind of overwrought commitment to a practice I really didn't understand and really thought I did. The period where I spent virtually every minute of a retreat or a workshop, seeker presentation, crying, weeping silently, leaking all over everything for no discernible reason. I was hideously embarrassed at first, but a very kind priest with whom I had a practice interview told me, oh yeah, everybody does that for better. Anyway, we were having a small group discussion at one point, the topic of which was basically, why have your life plans run off the rails? And what has been the effect of that on your path? Most of the stories were redemptive, bunking out of med school, losing a first love, horribly painful familial estrangements, stories of pain followed by a period of rebuilding and discovery of new possibilities. When it was my turn to speak, I had to say that I hadn't had an experience of having my life plan derailed. Not that I hadn't had pain, but I had never had a life plan. This assertion was met with typically soft-spoken and kind Buddhist remarks, all tending to the suggestion that I must be mistaken. A young woman who I had grown quite fond of in that kind of Zen retreat kind of way, you know, where you feel spiritual friendship that has actually nothing personal in it at all. Anyway, she said to the group, gazing very kindly at me the whole while, not everyone was comfortable thinking about some things, and that was perfectly okay. The consensus seemed to be that when I was ready for it, get to understanding that I really had had a plan and that it really had gone wrong, but good things had happened therefrom. Possibly true. So one purpose of a way-seeking mind talk is to tell the story, a story of how you got here. You got to the point where you had just somehow or other become a Zen priest. And it's for connecting the dots between all those grades. And I honestly did try to find my dots. I can maybe draw some connecting lines, but I really don't know what the story really is, because there's always, you know, more. I was always a voracious reader, never a planner, not even of that. Books came to my hands for reasons obscure to me then and now. My earliest reading addiction was biographies of people who had done great things. Favorite biography in the second grade was about the life and accomplishments of Marie Curie. She had a life and she did things that I had never imagined were possible. It was completely outside the range of the world, anything I knew about the world. And until I held that book in my hands, it was completely outside the range of my imagination. There it was. One had existed in this world who extended the boundaries I thought I knew. Girls were like this, lived lives like that. And the world provided plans that made all that pop, made all that happen. Having read that paperback into mulch, one of the things I took away was an understanding that there were, then and always, people living their lives in a world, a reality, utterly and completely different from that my world was not the world, and that there were, unknown to me and unseen by me, but still affecting and reverberating in the world I thought, whole other dimensions and possibilities, whether I could see them or not. What I could do is visit those worlds, be affected by them. Other biographies followed, of course, and at some point, and this must have been a nudge from my way-seeking mind, because I know I never planned it, I somehow eased over to a different set of libraries. Discovered, or was discovered by, imaginary biographies, anthropological adventures, that is to say, the novel. Imagination. Words, words, and more words. Up to worlds, worlds, and more worlds. No matter that, I knew that someone had managed to make it all up. Once read, those worlds and realities existed, built by imagination and word management, and resulting in my actually having feelings and investments and identifications with worlds and people I couldn't see on the phone or celebrate birthdays. At the beginning of this talking, said my mind is a gerund. English teacher alert. Gerund is a verb. It is non-finite, continuous, ongoing, and it's unruly as to categories and categorizing, being both noun and verb. Neither noun nor verb. It has two forms, two for the active, two for the passive voice. Having loved, having been loved, loving, being loved. And in my ceremony of Denkai, our teacher, Sensei Algenkai, transmitted the precepts of Buddhism, and it took this kind of form. Teacher offers the precept, be one with the Buddha. Student replied, with a gerund, being one with the Buddha. Buddhism, then, is also a gerund. Simple, but not. And to my mind, this gerundial condition is often called the ineffable, source of our yearning, the actualizing that is seeking. The way, our way, is not a sense of answers. It does not ask or command that we believe something or anything. In fact, it asks us to accept nothing we haven't demonstrated to ourselves to be true. Be working. It presents us with a way to connect with them more, and a way to actualize a life that is founded on questioning rather than answers. As a child reading Marie Curie's life with a flash under the covers, I think I was seeking what I am seeking. More that is out there and in here. The imagination of worlds embodied in writing and reading was a way to tune in, however momentarily, to the astounding, stupefying fact. You know, even though you don't know, you can know it and be being with it, be seeking in it and with it. There are ways to do that. Novels, poetry, art, music, acts of kindness offered or received, and also more formal portal. Zen rituals, chanting together and sitting still together in silence, not interacting, but being with one another, and all the dimensions of our world. These and other rituals are intimations being with that more. Tradition uses the words absolute reality and relative reality. And to tell you the truth, I used to get those mixed. Flip them around like a title switch. But they're not really denotationally accurate, but they point to them more, and to that yearning. And that is possibly and perhaps a defining feature of our humanness. And here I am, once again stupefied. Our tradition offers us tools for living with that stupefaction. Zazen, sitting still, not believing our beliefs. Our thoughts come and go like clouds in the sky. And somehow actualizing all that in a world that includes retrogrades, living balls of mosses, made up people we love and hate, every bit of our being, living, sitting, standing, seeking, gerund life. God, thank you for being fellow travelers. Thank you for sitting here in patience. Presented to you some shards of my gerundial satisfaction. No, stupefaction. Thank you for yearning and seeking and questioning, for being part of the more. Deep bows to you all. Maybe now we can hear some stuff about your seeking mind. No, you got them. Give them up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Deep gratitude. So we do have opportunity now for observations and questions. Linda is going to go ahead and
turn recorder off.
Oh, thank you. I'll do that in just a moment. Linda is going to go ahead and respond to those questions or observations directed toward her. I'm going to go ahead and keep an eye on who is requesting to speak at home as well as in person here. So we're going to stop the recording now.